This is Stuart Molina, music director of the Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra. And in this podcast, we will be talking about my favorite symphony in the repertoire. At least this week. Well, I add that caveat because generally I have to consider every piece that I'm doing as my favorite piece, but the Fourth Symphony has a special place in my heart on many different levels. I just think it's a phenomenal piece. But with that, one could argue the same for any other of the Brahms symphonies, any of the Beethoven symphonies. Well, you know what I mean. At any rate, suffice it to say, this is a piece that I really, really like. And I don't want to belabor too much in terms of discussion of this piece because it speaks so beautifully on its own. I will point out some of the things that I think are so wonderful about Brahms. If you talk to a musician about what composer he or she likes to play most, many of them will say Brahms, and I think that the reason is that it's a perfect synthesis of perfection in structure, gorgeous melodies, lush harmonies, wonderful textures, and counterpoint. In short, Brahms had all of the tools that were necessary to create wonderful music. He was a great melodist, he was a great counterpointist, he was a great orchestrator, and he was able to infuse his music with deep emotion. He also was very meticulous in his preparation of music. Unlike Beethoven, who left piles and piles of manuscripts and discarded versions of music, Brahms destroyed everything except the final manuscripts. So we're left to wonder what his methodology was, just how much of this was formed in his mind and how much was worked out on paper. In the end, it really doesn't matter. It's a beautiful piece. And I think the Fourth Symphony of Brahms, from the very beginning, captures you and does not release you. It's one of the most stunning openings of a piece. And when you look at how it's constructed, all the more astonishing in that it has such an effect. Basically, Brahms just uses a set of descending thirds. Alternating minor thirds with major thirds. But he also uses these thirds in inversion, which is what allows this piece to have such breadth and makes interesting what would otherwise be a very pedestrian melody. So he has a descending, and then going up a sixth, which is the same as a descending third, displaced by an octave. So again, this beautiful melody. But he goes further. He gives little breaths, little sighs built into it, almost as though the orchestra is trying to catch its breath in an emotional outpouring. And then beneath it, this wonderful texture, which I can't possibly approximate on a piano. And then we're in it. And we are emotionally caught up, and he holds on to us for the entirety of this piece. These thirds become kind of a theme of the entire work. As you'll see, he brings them back both in their literal form, descending thirds or rising thirds, or as contours of a melody pretty much throughout the entire symphony. For example, because he alternates minor and major thirds, it can be the outline of a minor triad, or, starting from a major third, a major triad. So the second theme of the piece is built around this major triad. Continuing on with this section, he gives us a new theme, which begins with a seventh, but always ends with the outline of a third. That's a third. So once again. And here's another third. So you can see he's now playing around with this idea of the interval of a third. But interestingly here, the accompaniment is our literal descending thirds. So with the melody, we get something like this. So you can see he's again using this notion of repeated thirds one after another, not just in a melodic way, but also in an accompaniment harmonic way. The next theme features yet another variation on this three-note motive. This time, instead of just the three notes, he adds another passing note, so that the theme is. Again, just more variations. He then creates a variation on that, adding yet another passing tone. It's Brahms, the incredible composer, at work. He has endless imagination for variation, for creating little differences that make an amazingly interesting piece of music. You'll hear a soft murmury part in the strings, which is yet another kind of variation. Instead of a simple three-note triad, this time a diminished triad, you'll hear him do the same thing but use the sides of the upper note before playing that note. Let me play it for you. Again, starting instead of this, and then this is directly followed by yet another use of the three-note motive. Just a simple fanfare, but again, just another wonderful variation. The second movement begins with the three notes, one more time, this time in the solo horn. The first movement was in E minor, and ends very strongly. You couldn't have much more blatant a statement of E minor than that. The second movement begins with the horn, playing three notes up, and then three notes down. We don't really know what key we're in. We know that there's no longer an F sharp, which would be part of an E minor scale. It could be some kind of E Phrygian. That would be a little bit odd for Brahms. It also could be C major, some kind of a serene movement in C, or perhaps it could be in A minor, some kind of A minor natural scale. Who knows? So it's a very ambiguous opening. And it's only made clear when the woodwinds enter and the strings play. And indeed, we are in E major, which is very odd because E major has an F sharp and a G sharp. And this piece began. So where exactly are we? Well, as it turns out, the introduction is no more than that. Just a simple introduction, both to the main motive and to the feeling of the piece, which is rather stately, expressive. And so, this is how the opening goes, just so you can hear this transition from this where are we, C major, E Phrygian, or what, into E major. the loveliest melodies in all of Brahms. Simple melody for the woodwinds, clarinets, and bassoon, accompanied by pizzicato strings, that is, strings just plucking their instruments, not playing with a bow. And here, too, there's a slight ambiguity. It's not standard E major, which would be... We'll get that a little bit later, but at the beginning, it's this alternation between an E harmony with F sharp and G sharp, and this hint of a C harmony, or an A minor harmony. Listen to what I mean. This D natural, which would otherwise be a D sharp leading to E, gives it this melancholy nostalgia, which is one of the most obvious feelings of this entire work. So, anyway, going forward, the second theme of the second movement, again, plays around with the three-note motive. Three notes up. Three notes down. With a little bit of a variation. And onward it goes. There's a section in triplets, which is much stronger. Again. Three up. Three down. He's nothing if not consistent. And the second theme takes this and creates a lyrical melody around it. This simple melody, simple motive, three up, three down. Finally, at the end of this second movement, Brahms explains himself as far as the introduction is concerned. He brings back the horn melody, but now fully harmonized, and we find out that indeed it is a synthesis of E and C. I don't know, call me a softy, but I think that is extraordinary music. Never fails to touch my heart. The third movement is the one that departs somewhat from the exclusive use of this three-note motive. It's a explosive, joyful, jolly C major. Now, C major is a slightly odd choice for a work in E minor, but I think that this choice of C major makes it all the more effusive in its exaltation. But this is a very different kind of piece.
he most obviously brings the thirds back in the transition into the second theme. And here you'll hear it first in the basses and then in the upper woodwinds. I'll play it a little bit slowly. Almost as if to say, yes, audience, this is in fact part of my fourth symphony, and it does fit in with what I've done in the first movement. But it's followed again with a very simple, joyful, almost folk-like melody. And that's pretty much all of the tools that he needs to create this piece. There is one serene moment in the middle of this movement where he slows things down and gives us a little bit more of a lyrical approach to some of the material. It begins in being introduced with a wonderful transition going from F major to F minor and landing in D flat major. Before it explodes once again for a very joyful and powerful finish. The final movement of Brahms' Fourth Symphony is a passacaglia. A passacaglia uses a melody, usually a fairly short one, in repetition with variation over the melody. In the case of this E minor passacaglia in the Fourth Symphony, this is the melody. A scale in E minor, adding a sharp fourth, and then what's called a cadence, moving from the fifth degree to the first degree. Harmonized, it creates a very intense opening. Brahms brings the trombones in for the first time in the piece, so we have that new somber sonority. What's amazing about this piece is we see Brahms as the great writer of variations. Interestingly, it's the only time in the symphonies that we see variations. He did write the Haydn variations for orchestra, and he also wrote several sets of variations for piano. And he's amazingly adventurous and inventive in his approach to variation form. In this particular piece, there are many, many variations. There would have to be, because it's such a short theme. He starts right away by giving us a new texture and a new rhythm to the melody, and also a pedal. So in other words, he takes and breaks it down even further to its bare bones skeleton. With the passacaglia theme coming on the second beat. The next variation gives us a melodic variation on top of the melody. Hasakaya theme is still there, it's now secondary. We're hearing it in the low strings. Continuing on, he now takes an even grander approach, bringing in more instruments. And this ushers in a new, very expressive section, where again, we have the Passacaglia theme, but now it's relegated to a bass line. And this is followed by several variations on that melody. Continuing on, we have, and I'm skipping many of them just for time constraints, we have a variation where, again, the Passacaglia melody is in the bass, but things are becoming much more active. And then even more active. Then things slow down, and we have a set of variations in halftime. Actually, I guess it would be double time, twice as slow, featuring first a solo in the flute. And the flute is basically taking the contour of the Passacaglia theme and creating a beautiful, lyrical, melodic variation on it. A short variation on the flute's variation in major, we have an entrance of the trombones again with a very beautiful chorale melody. Brahms could write such an amazing line. Well, after this section, we have a return to the opening statement, another set of variations on that Passacaglia theme, even more intensely than the first statement. And at one point, we have a return to the motive from the very beginning. This is not to say that he abandons the Passacaglia. No, he uses the descending thirds as a variation on the Passacaglia theme. So it sounds like this. It's as though, once again, Brahms is saying, okay, we haven't heard it in a while. I'll give you a little bit of a taste of it, but it will get much more obvious in the final variation. Before the coda, the final section, in which you have a very blatant statement of the opening descending thirds, this time in canon, from the basses and celli to the violins. more blatant could he be, saying, this is the Fourth Symphony, this is my motive, and I am going to bring this piece to a close, being introduced by that opening theme. But the piece does end with the Passacaglia theme, this time in a faster tempo, and he brings it home, again, very powerfully, very emotionally, and brilliantly. This is one of the great classics. You could say the same for all the Brahms symphonies, but these pieces are played again and again for a good reason. They speak to an audience no matter what the time is, because it speaks to elements in the human soul and glorifies the human soul through being so perfect. I think it's a wonderful fitting end to what I consider one of our most wonderful programs. Hope to see you there.